In this episode of the Neil Wilkins podcast, I'm joined by Mark Fawcett, who is the founder of We Are Futures, an award-winning agency that helps organizations, businesses to do more and better work with their engagement with young people. I think that's getting it right. Am I right there, Mark? Is that the general kind of premise of your purpose
here? Yes. Yes, I think that's succinct and to the point.
Brilliant. Wonderful. I don't want to start there, though, because I guess when anybody kind of finds a true purpose, and clearly with the sorts of organizations that you're influencing and kind of working with now, it's almost that you've reached that that sort of summit of a mountain of a journey that clearly you didn't just jump straight into this. It was clearly something that over a number of years, quite a number of years, I'm sure, was something that you've had to build and put a lot of blood, sweat and tears kind of into. So I'm really curious and interested in the journey. Because I guess a lot of people have, you know, lots of great ambitions and dreams to kind of really make a difference. But it's only really a few, I guess, that could sort of say that they're making a profound difference to audiences or to communities or to businesses in a true sense. So I'm very interested to kind of understand the journey that has brought you, you know, to this position right here. So where did it all begin for you?
Well, it didn't begin in that there was a moment of enlightenment. I think all through my older school years and university years, I had been a bit experimental with ways of sort of making money, a little entrepreneurial without knowing what the word probably meant at that time. But then that all took a backseat after university when I joined the army. And I was in the army for about 5 years doing various roles through infantry and intelligence. But what I really enjoyed during that time was the training side of it, because you bring a lot of young men, very young men, 17, 18, 19, into the military, often with up to that period of time, low achievement, low academic qualifications, certainly. And the training enabled these young men to grow, to fulfill their potential. And I became very interested in that side of development. And after about 5 years, I left the army. I joined an organization called World Challenge, which runs expeditions for school-age young people all over the world. And as part of the process, they raise funds for their expedition. They learn about it, the country they're going to, and then they go away for a month where they lead the expedition themselves within groups. And the role of the adult expedition leaders with them is really to facilitate their personal development. It's like an intensive management and leadership training program over a month for teenagers. So doing that, I visited well over 300 schools, mostly in the UK, some in the United States as well, and just saw more and more of what outside organizations were doing in and around young people's development. So these were businesses, charities, government-funded functions, and just adding value bit by bit to young people, to their education, their development. And I just thought that, first of all, this was really very important, because a young person, especially one from a less advantaged background, needs a lot more than just a curriculum subject-based education. And secondly, with perhaps the arrogance of youth, I thought all of this could be done a lot better than it was being done. And that led ultimately to the creation of We Are Futures, which was launched or started 18 years ago as National Schools Partnership. And our first attempts to go out to businesses and say, look, get more involved with how young people are learning and developing, because it's good for you and it's good for them. And that's really where it all started. And I then found myself in this area centered around the combination of marketing and, as it was much more actively called then, CSR, corporate social responsibility, without really having ever worked at that time actively in either. I certainly do not have a classically trained marketing or brand background.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we often, I guess, find, you know, in life, as we kind of sort of reflect back on kind of how we got to where we are, that there are all these little kind of moments that are really informative, that kind of just give you a sense of, okay, I feel like I'm in the right place. And then they kind of guide you into something which, I guess, if you'd set out to plan this, you possibly would never have ended up kind of where you are. So is it a case really of kind of listening on the journey? So when you spot these little moments, and I'm sure, you know, visiting all of those schools, there must have been lots of moments where you thought, this is kind of really reinforcement for being in the right place and doing the right thing. Was it more a case of you went with the flow, or did you at those kind of points think, right, I'm really creating something around this now?
I think it's a combination of small learnings or changes which you don't necessarily identify at the time, but hindsight gives you the view of saying, actually, that was really important then. And that period of time was where I can see now how certain thoughts crystallized. So that was part of it. But for me, it was also partly a moment in time, in that I had been a managing director of two very, very different businesses, of World Challenge and then of a tech startup. And I therefore had worked in these leadership roles for other people. And I was in my mid-30s with two children. My wife was working. And I thought that if I'm going to do my own thing, if I'm going to really carve out my own path and direction, this was the time to do it. It felt I had enough experience that I would have a reasonable chance of success, but I was also young enough to think that, well, if I muck it up, then I will still be able to go back into employment.
So was it a case in that moment that you felt it was really all about you? I mean, without being completely egocentric about it, is that kind of journey very much driven by a sense of, I know what is right and I know what I can achieve here? Or was it more of a collaborative thing? Were you taking kind of counsel from others? Were you kind of, and I always kind of think of the work that I do as being much more a sort of an alchemy. So, you know, I can't remember the last time I had an original idea. I kind of take other people's ideas and then work collaboratively to make them into something. And I'm always curious about how people kind of make something as big as, you know, the work that you're doing now, make something a reality, because otherwise it could have just always ended up as just a pure dream, couldn't it?
Well, I think that at the start point, it certainly wasn't just me on my own with my ego saying I have a vision and I know what I can go and do. It was a lot more scary than that. It was also a lot more unknown, and it was certainly a lot more collaborative. There were two friends of mine in particular who were equal with me in helping shape the idea of what then became National Schools Partnership, and now We Are Futures, the early stage of the idea, at least. They were very much part of that. As it turns out, once we got the business going, they didn't work in it, but they helped with some funding into it. Once we got it going, the original idea actually turned it out to not be a particularly good idea. And the sort of secondary idea that we had running alongside it, which was much more about the provision of advice and marketing services and consultancy, that became the driving force of the agency. And we stopped completely what the original idea had actually been. So I think it's a collaborative process, definitely, but it's one that I very much took the lead on. I couldn't have done it alone, but it also wouldn't have happened unless I had had enough combination of just determination, a good sprinkling of ego, I'm sure, and certainly a belief that this was the time for me to try and do something that I could really shape. The timing was absolutely right for me to give it my best shot.
So there's kind of like an intuitive knowing, isn't there, sort of within this, that you just kind of feel, if I don't do this now, one, the moment could pass, and two, I think I've just about got enough resources, so the right people around me, just a level of experience and knowledge, and obviously the technical skills of, you know, being a leader and having those leadership kind of qualities, which, you know, obviously needing to be prevalent in, you know, a role like you were performing. It kind of almost feels it's the perfect storm then, does it? Is that kind of the moment when you sort of think it's now?
At the time, I think it just felt more like a storm than a perfect storm. I think that one of the things that one thing's definitely the army taught me, but it consciously does teach its leaders, is you have to make a decision. So obviously they're teaching about decisions being made in extreme circumstances, extreme environments, but they definitely teach the worst thing you can do is be indecisive. You have to make a decision and then push forward. So for me, during the starting of this business, or many times since then, it's been, well, do I do A or do I do B? But what I have to do is pick one of them. I can't just leave the decision for another 3 months or another 6 months, whether that's about a person, whether that's about approach to work, whether that's about funding, direction, strategy of the business. It's do the best plan you can, but then make a decision and get on with it.
There are just so many wonderful anecdotes that, you know, I've had sort of drip fed to me through, you know, people who have been within the military sort of over the years. And I always think this is where real wisdom comes from. You know, some of the very best leaders that I've worked for, you know, back earlier in my career were from military backgrounds. And I just always remember thinking, that was so valuable. I feel so grateful to have just experienced those anecdotes, those little moments where you think they're actually simple, but they're so profound. Make a decision is probably one of the simplest pieces of advice you could give anybody, but it's profound, isn't it? I mean, do you find when you're kind of advising and guiding, particularly some of the larger brands that you work with, it is about the decision-making process ultimately, because I'm sure there's no shortage of ideas.
I think that now the style of work and that we do and the approach that I take means that I very rarely actually have to say, no, I am going to now make the decision. And I think that I know that there are different ways in which you can apply leadership thinking and also different ways in which you can adapt your own leadership approach to different circumstances. So rarely am I the one saying, right, let's step in, we're going to do this, because I have such good people who have come through, both new and been with me many years in the agency, that I think they're in a position now where I am more of a shoulder, if you want, an advisor, someone to lean on, and a bit of a tester, because if they're the ones making the decisions, and they're the ones who have to deliver them, that's a far better circumstance in this type of work than if I have made a decision that someone else then has to go and deliver. I think there are sometimes exceptions to that. Obviously, a long 18 years of working and different sort of economic circumstances along the way, we've had to make tough decisions on a couple of times, not too often. The start of COVID, I think, was a clear example of where I stepped right back into decision-making mode. I took counsel from two of my most senior and experienced people, but we made a lot of decisions quickly. And it was a different style of management and leadership for those first few months. And very important, I think, for us that it was.
So I just, as you were describing that, I thought if I was a young person listening to you speak, it's almost quite comforting that there are people like you who are able to be kind of, I mean, true role models in kind of really moving their lives forward. I mean, did you feel like that? Do you feel as though you are the role model? Because the way you're eloquent, you're clearly wise, you have this, as you say, 18 years of experience within the business now, having, you know, all of these various contact points and the services and consultancy that you provide. That is role model, isn't it? Surely.
Well, I mean, my immediate reaction is one of slightly squirming and British embarrassment when you say that. But detached from that in a pragmatic way, then so many of us are role models in some way to others. Now, clearly, as part of my work, I actually consult and teach in so many different areas to businesses, to brands, to other organizations about how they connect with young people, and therefore the influence they have on young people, and also that young people have on them. So therefore, I have to know enough about that to be useful and to be credible and to make sure that the advice makes things better. So in that essence, I'm aware enough to know that, yes, I am, but just the way you describe it is probably a little too generous, I think. But even people who, you know, you don't have to think of yourselves as a role model to know that if you're in a position where people are looking at you and they're judging how you act, then you are a role model. You can also, of course, be a negative role model as well as a positive one. But at least if you have an awareness that people are looking at you, it might help you think and improve about how you relate and act towards those people.
I think you are. I can just tell by the way you describe these things and the way you bounce back from these strange questions that I'm posing to you. But I'm trying to get to the heart of the real mark here, obviously in a short period of time. And it's quite interesting to see how people react in, you know, those kinds of questions. But I mean, certainly having seen some, a lot of the work that you do, for me, there is no question here the amount of influence that, you know, you have in the roles and the kind of sort of brands that you're working with. So curious then, in terms of the starting point. So say, for example, I am somebody in a brand who becomes, say a big household familiar brand who becomes aware of the work in the organization and says, Mark, we need to have a conversation. This is something we've been toying with for a while. Can you describe to us where we'd begin? What kind of process, what kind of activities and conversations would you have at that stage?
I mean, we obviously have, as an organization that works through from consultancy through to creative idea generation through to activation, we have the processes that allow us to do that well and efficiently that we have developed over time. Processes are critically important, not always the most exciting things to talk about. But I think what we do first of all is we help an organization understand what young people mean to them. And that is often one of the hardest things, because they may just come from the presumption of, okay, well, we want to sell product to 16 to 24 year olds, or actually they are going to emerge into our market soon and we have to understand them. But what we do is we help them get underneath the real depth of the value of young people to that organization. And as an example of that, if you're, let's say, a major supermarket in the UK and you're thinking about 16 to 24 year olds and you're not prioritizing them because they don't have the biggest basket spend in your supermarket. But what you're missing a trick with there is that those 16 to 24 year olds, if you take one of the mid-sized supermarkets in the UK, over the next 3 to 4 years, as they start emerging more and more into independent shopping, the value of their basket as they spend more is such that if there's about 0.5% shift in whether those young people think you're the supermarket for me or not, that's values of $500 million and upwards annually for those supermarkets. So these are very, very big numbers. And so we get them to understand value. We also get them to understand value in the different directions, because what happens now is, and I can come on to this, is there's no longer this separation between what you might have called a consumer brand and an employer brand. They're very much merged now, because the channels that both are communicated through merge, and the perception a young person gets of you as a company about whether I want to buy from you is the same as whether I want to work for you. And so when you take this fictitious mid-sized massive UK supermarket, then at the same time as do I want to shop from you, It's, do I want to work for you? And right now we're in this huge competition for talent in the UK. And if some of that top talent really wants to work for you or doesn't, that again is a value of many, many hundreds of millions of pounds over time. So you have all of these aspects together. There's the consumer, there's the employee. And the third aspect is that young people today have the ability to be disruptive influencers of your brand reputation and the ability to do it very, very quickly and powerfully. So if you are the supermarket, and let's say you pick up quite quickly a bad reputation for environmental practices, young people react in a way that is going to cost you a huge amount in your revenue over the next 5 to 10 years, a massive amount in much harder to measure costs about them not wanting to work with you. And also they're going to go after your reputation and they're going to encourage other people to think as badly of you as they do. So if as an organization, you get a little bit of better understanding of, okay, this is what young people and young adults might mean to me as a customer, what they might mean to me as a future employee and colleague, and what they might mean to me in terms of their ability to influence what others think, this suddenly becomes a lot more important to you than it was 10 years ago and 20 years ago, when those young generations did not have the same level of care or ability to connect these different brands and to actually influence them. So that's sort of a long-winded answer. The first step is understand what young people mean to your business. Then what we do is help those businesses understand what young people think of them. So, for example, one of the things we launched last year was our social impact barometer, which listens to basically the voices of about 85,000 young people and what they're saying about 100 different brands around the UK. And they're judging those brands on the depth of emotional connection, what they like as a career maker, how they treat the individual, how they treat the environment. And that allows us to provide information to the market and go, look, this is what young people are saying about you. This is the language they're using about you. And once you start adding those two things together, then businesses can get a much better perception. Okay, this is how important young people are. Therefore, what should we do next? That's the start point, really. Sometimes it's deep consultancy. Sometimes it's more, let's just take a rough picture and then think about the way forward from there.
This is a whole new audience, isn't it? I mean, I think all of us intuitively know that this, you might call them the TikTok generation, and obviously there are other more formal descriptions of this emerging generation, but this whole kind of different style of behavior where, as you absolutely correctly say, it isn't just about purely are they going to purchase. It is the other points of influence from we can mess with your brand if you don't get it right. And we are your social conscience. And it's often that is how it's perceived, I think, by a lot of, certainly consumer brands, is that the social conscience is outside of the organization. So we have to be super careful not to greenwash, not to be even hinting that we're not doing things properly, because we will get picked up, and it won't be the more mature audiences who will do it. It will be the emerging generation. That's really important. And that is something I think for a lot of organizations, particularly you might sort of term them B2B or business to business, which is different to high street retail, a lot of people will understand. I guess certainly in my travels, quite a bit of resistance to really embracing this stuff. And I'll kind of sort of challenge whether you're seeing this as well, because some organizations will say, well, to be honest, at the moment times are really tough. So what we need to do is kind of focus on the today, because they don't currently have a spend. That's not our customer. I hear that a lot. That's really not our target customer. And no matter how many times I say to them, yeah, but look, 5-10 years time, honestly, they are going to be your customer, because they're the children of the parents who are actually purchasing your products right now. They will be the decision makers. They'll be the budget holders. Do you see there's still a resistance to going and spending effort? I mean, if you were talking there strategically about some of these brands, did you still find there's resistance to thinking about the tomorrow?
The resistance, or the lack of understanding, is diminishing. And it's diminishing each year. I think that there are a number of reasons for that. One, that people who are now making decisions within those businesses, you know, have grown up over the last 20 years as opposed to the last 40 years. So people are coming in with an attitude where purpose and values are genuinely much more important to them, even if they don't use those words and that language. We've also clearly seen that the impact of COVID and the lockdowns has forced every organization to just think a little bit about what is their purpose in the community in which they exist. What do they contribute towards the world beyond a product and a profit? And we find it rarer and rarer that a business doesn't genuinely care about that now, rather than perhaps 15 years ago when it may have been ticking the box of a corporate responsibility report. So I think there's still resistance, but it's more understanding that this adds value. It adds commercial results. It adds benefit, not only because businesses staff expect it as well. And we see that a lot in the clients that we work with, that the work we do then shows up in their internal staff measurements in terms of increases in employee pride, increases in retention. And let's not forget that with especially younger workers, they also comment through platforms, forums, social media about what it's like to work where they work. And they're happy to be very vocal about it. The sense of loyalty for life for an employer is largely gone. So whatever environment you're in, your people demand it, your stakeholders demand it, and the environment in which you exist requires you more and more to be a positive contributor, not just a sort of net taker, if you want. So it's harder and harder for businesses to operate as a selfish silo, really.
So the old model then of, okay, we need to figure out our purpose because we need to be more sustainable. We need to get, you know, our CSR credentials up. So we're going to have a board meeting, figure out what our purpose is, and then tell everybody in the organization, this is our purpose and everybody needs to follow suit. It feels that is now such an outdated approach. And going forward, it really needs to be embracing maybe, you know, a new generation of you know, potential employees and potential decision makers in the future that are coming out of college and coming out of school. Would brands like the ones that you're talking to, would they beginning to almost sort of couch the opinions of this younger generation as they create their strategies for the future? Because that would seem really positive.
Yes, I mean, that they do more and more, particularly on areas to do with young talent, young recruitment, HR, and that side of things. Particularly in those areas, they're understanding that there is a different desire amongst people coming into the workforce now than there was a decade ago and a decade before that. So, for example, amongst our research with young people, and this age group, so we're talking about 16, 24 for this, about what they want from a career. And the number one thing that came out of everything else was being happy in my career. This came above how much money I might earn and a whole load of other things, and also things beyond career. They want to feel that they have a purpose in their career. They are adding value. They are not creating a negative impact upon the world. They want to be able to communicate with positive pride about what they do. And so they are placing much higher value judgments on the businesses that they will go and work for about what they expect. And this balances across to their role as customers as well, placing those higher standards. And these, we're not just talking about, oh, well, young people have always been like this. It's comparing this generation at this age with older generations when they were the same age. So the differences are very stark. And one thing I talk about sometimes is this potential idea of putting away the thought about consumer brand and employer brand, putting that away, and instead thinking much more about the joining of messaging and channels, and that you can't separate these things. Instead of thinking something like, perhaps, what is our community brand rather than our consumer brand, our employer brand, because if they feel that they are part of the same community as you, they are more likely to join in both as a buyer and as a worker and as an advocate, rather than as a critic and somebody who won't come near you to either buy from you or work with you.
Yeah, this is a whole different way of kind of creating strategy, isn't it? I mean, if I think again of some of the organizations that I'm working with, where, you know, strategy either is bottom up or top down, and you create this kind of vision for the future, but it's almost done in an ivory tower. You know, we have our research, we know what our product development timeline is, et cetera, et cetera. But it's kind of all about us. I think what you're describing here is something that is so much more future-proofed, because it is the people who are going to be the customers. It is that same person who is also going to be the potential employee. It feels like when Mark Carney a few years ago said, you know, organizations who don't embrace, you know, this kind of a purpose-driven business are going to be out of business. It feels like that actually most people jumped onto the process and product bandwagon when they heard that, because they thought, oh, we've got to get better, slicker processes. But actually what you're advocating is it's much more about the people. We need to be bringing people into the mix here, or even before we start thinking product and process.
Absolutely. It's, you know, we risk going into to sort of cliche area in a way, but this is a human race, and everything that we do and think about that drives our greatest emotions, positive and negative, are human orientated. And so to place, you don't want to place product and process at the heart of it. You want to place people at the heart of it, both the people you have, the people you want to come and work with you, and the people you want to purchase from you. And if those people have strong, positive association and engagement with you, and they have a belief that your values match them, if you can achieve that, you're at a level way above what you can be by focusing only on the sort of product, the supply chain, the process side of things. And it's not easy, but leadership at the top of businesses can make a huge amount of difference. And we see that when, you know, chief executive A or B at the top of these big businesses, multi-brand businesses, are saying, we are putting this at the heart of what we do, it flows through and it drives the commercial results. Big, big numbers being driven by this as well. It sets you up against competition, and it largely starts future-proofing you as well. So it's absolute win-win-win in terms of commercial impact, brand impact, and social impact working together.
And it's almost then that it kind of almost negates this whole word greenwashing, because just by definition, if you're including the people in the future who are going to be buying and are going to be working for your organization, it's almost there's no space or time or opportunity to be greenwashing, because you won't need to, because actually they've created the very thing that they're looking to buy anyway, so that there is no place for a greenwashing message to hide, because everything is pure and authentic and transparent and true and honest, and because the people who are buying it are the people who have created it. If I'm reading this right.
Sometimes this can get mistaken for the sort of thing that small companies do or social enterprises do. But it's actually that the power is driven when large organizations do it and do it successfully. And then what they see is this, and we sometimes talk about story doing rather than storytelling. In other words, don't worry about the story you're going to tell about it, which is sort of getting into the area of greenwashing. But think instead about what you're actually going to do. Go and do those positive things that those communities that you exist in want to see from you. Do those things, and then the storytelling becomes remarkably easy. And in fact, all of the people within your organization will start telling the story on your behalf. So focus on the story doing first, and then the storytelling becomes easier, and part of it will take care of itself.
That's if there was ever a little golden moment in the conversation. I'm always on the hunt for the little golden moment because that's the bit that makes the little short promo snap shot of it. I think that was it. Story doing, not storytelling. That's one for people to pause and think about, I think there, definitely. So you mentioned, obviously, I want to come back to the social impact barometer that you described earlier. Sort of come back to that in just a moment. But if somebody's listening to this, and you know, maybe they're a marketer, or they're a decision maker, or they're a senior executive, and that they listen and they think, okay, you've told me, you know, kind of part of the how I do this. But these 16 to 24s, what else are they really interested in? What else is keeping them up at night? What else are they going to be critiquing my brand for? Are there any other kind of sort of main trends that you would say people should be on the lookout for right now?
We have developed over many years what we call seven principles. These seven principles of better engagement with young people, and they have been developed through a huge amount of quantitative, qualitative co-creation, working with our Young Leaders Network and other to get thinking like, what's the advice and how can we distill this down? So there are four characteristics we often talk about as being statistically significantly different from this generation at this age than other generations when they were at the same age. The first is that they are much more fluid. They're much more fluid in their interests, their friendship groups, their tastes. They expect to have four jobs by the time they've been 30. They're not feeling as need to be set perhaps in a type as in I listen to this type of music or I'm in this type of fashion wearing group. It's much more fluid than that. So fluidity, number one. Second, and sadly, they are more anxious. They are more lonely. They are more concerned about issues around them, whether that is fairness and social equality, whether that is poverty, whether it's the environment. So they have a high level of anxiety. Third is that they are really prepared to fight for fairness, and they don't necessarily believe in the established political systems as the way to go about that. So they're saying, no, we'll just do it our way. And this fighting for fairness on every level, they really actually. They just can't see how the generations behind before them have created this environment where it's not fair for some people and it is for others, which could depend on everything from your sex to your race to your religion. And the fourth is what I mentioned earlier, this really strong desire to be happy in their career. Whereas I think previous generations will have tolerated unhappiness in their career because they wanted security and they wanted money and they wanted promotion. And this, though, no, I want to be happy in my career and I will move on to something else if I am feeling I am, you know, in an environment that doesn't make me happy. So these four characteristics become very important. And we're able to help us to see how these characteristics apply to them, whether they're looking as younger as customers or they're looking as future employees. So that's one aspect of it. And then the seven principles, and I won't run through all of those because there's seven, but the seven principles spin out of that and allow us to say, therefore, if you are a business trying to sell to or do good social activity or hire from this age group, think about these specific principles because we know now with evidence and with experience that if you pick one of those principles and you improve it in your organization, it will flow through to this audience, including the ones who already work for you. So yes, there are actual tools that the businesses can use, and they don't have to go in the whole hog. You know, we're going to transform everything we do with young people over the next 2 years. They can just start, you know, at a certain place and say, look, let's just look how we're dealing with the diversity of our graduate intake. So we have a really fair level playing field. Therefore, we'll get better talent and we will know we are doing this the right way. And the people who come and work for us will know we're doing it the right way. So you can pick that, or you can look at, you know, aspects of your product and think about how they are particularly relating to the principles of better engagement with young people. Think, are we doing this the best that we can? So you can come at it from a start point and then just build really from there.
So it feels like the principles are there to be molded in such a way that it becomes almost personalized for your own brand,
Oh, it's
which is
always got
neat.
to be personalized. Always has to be, because it has to make sense to your particular brand, and not even to your, your sector or your business. But if you're working with one car manufacturer and then working with another, that they're different, they have different values. And so you're thinking about how do those values relate to young people? If the values relate perfectly, let's just better communicate them to young people. But also, if the values you have do not chime with young people and these emerging adults coming through, do you therefore need to have a think about those values, because you're going to get further and further behind the curve?
So one of the measures that we've had in marketing for, well, centuries, I guess, to measure what you might term, well, in old school speak, brand loyalty, is the customer lifetime value, the CLV, some kind of sort of numerical measure or anecdotal measure of the value of a particular customer or persona or demographic group. It feels like this needs to change. It feels like there's almost like a new measure required, because if the emerging audience, 16 to 24 currently, but obviously very, very soon they're going to be older than that, they're going to be making decisions and this, that, and the other. It feels as though if they're very fluid in their behaviors and their attitudes, if they are feeling anxiety and we maybe have a service or a product that can sort of help sort of not solve it, but help sort of in their journey with that. And it is a very kind of emerging sort of mindset for them. It feels like there needs to almost be a new measure of success when it comes to brand loyalty, because it could be argued that trying to sort of fit the old model into this new emerging sort of demographic is kind of just trying to fit a square block into a round hole. It doesn't necessarily feel quite appropriate anymore. Do we need something new to measure brand loyalty? Because it feels like that's going to be quite hard to do.
I think brand loyalty as a pure measurement is a very limiting one. It's very narrow. It measures what it says on the tin, but what it doesn't do is really measure the value of the person or the people or the community, because somebody who may or may not buy from you regularly may also be hugely full of praise for you, or hugely full of criticism for you. And this younger generation is going to be far more outspoken in both their praise and their criticism. So they can be boosting or damaging your brand and barely recognizing actually as a loyal customer themselves. And linked to that, and that's just talking about the consumer brand side of things, it doesn't bring into it at all the employer brand side of things, in terms of, do they want to work for you? What are they saying to their friends who go and work for you? I can't believe you're working for them, or wow, I'm really jealous, I'd love to work there. And these have values. They have, real commercial values in terms of what is being said about you. So every time an organization is putting out their a job advert, or they are doing a piece of recruitment activity or running an interview, or they are doing an ad spot, or they are nailing down their earned media or using their own products, every time they're doing any one of these, they are building this joint consumer and employer brand, this community brand, if you want. And there is no measurement of the overall value and the overall impact of the activity they have when they are communicating with the outside world. So yes, probably long-winded answer to it's very narrow, that form of measurement, and really doesn't reflect the value, either the value you're driving if you're doing it well, or the negative impact you're driving if you're not.
So it feels then that there's a real need for really consistent and really open social listening. Well, let's call it community listening, because you're describing this as now sort of community engagement, which obviously encompasses the whole piece here. So as a marketer, as a business owner, you're really going to have to be properly listening, aren't you? There's nowhere to hide here in this new world.
Absolutely not. You know, whether it's a global, a national, a regional, or a local community, you are more joined up with that community than you have ever been. That is only going to increase going forward. And unless you're communicating with and engaging with that community on all the levels that we've already discussed, as a purchaser, as a potential employer, as someone who's influencing opinion about you, if you're only engaged on the consumer selling side, you're not getting the whole picture, nor are you actually having a relationship with them. So yeah, it needs to change. And it's really interesting seeing those organizations that are taking steps to do this.
So would an organization looking to move this forward, obviously one, they need to speak to Mark, first of all, but two, it kind of feels then that this is multidisciplinary. So the HR or talent development or people in development team or person needs to talk to the marketers, needs to talk to the production sort of facilities, needs to talk to. So it's kind of, it really is multidisciplinary. There's no one kind of place within the organization that really owns this, is there? Because it feels like it proliferates right across any kind of size of business.
Well, it's definitely multidiscipline, but that is hard at first for large organizations, because even though over the last 15 years or so, there's been much closer alignment between what might have been in the past the marketing department and then the corporate or CSR function, both the terminology and working practices of those areas have come much closer together. The HR and talent and skills side, in nearly all organizations, sits very differently. They're using their own channels to communicate. We see contradictory messages coming out in terms of the personality and values that they're giving across. But the important thing is you don't have to tackle all of this in one go. So what we would urge is to make a start, to think about it, make a start, start making some improvements and changes in some area, and then start talking internally with colleagues. There's one organization we've worked with for many, many years, and we're almost about to get their young talent and HR people in the room with their marketing people. And it's taken us years because, you know, they're big, big places and they're busy, busy. So they don't need to overly sweat it at the beginning thinking this is an all or nothing. Either I have to change the whole organization or there's no point. Just start taking steps and it will show dividends quickly.
It feels like an evolution, not a revolution. You've got to be patient, I'm guessing, is what you're saying, really, isn't it?
I think is the way I'd probably describe a conscious evolution, as in conscious we are going to evolve this rather than we have to have a revolution today.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's really good. So let's just kind of almost sort of project into the future. Say 5 years, I mean, 10 years is way too long for any time scale. The horizon seems every year is coming sort of, you know, closer to us. But say 5 years' time, what would this look like to you from a personal perspective? Kind of where will we all collectively be in regard to young people, do you think?
I think if I could start by just thinking about where one large company might be in 5 years. All of the areas and functions that connect with young people would all have a common understanding of what young people think of them to begin with. They would also all have a common understanding of what the value of young people is to that organization. So what does it matter? What do the young people matter to us? If they have those two common values across the whole organization, understanding and values across the organization. And then they have a third thing, which they build out of that, which is just a common approach to telling their story. So they use the first two to create the third. Now, if that's all they do, they will be communicating out and engaging to their young communities far more effectively with actions and words that resound far more strongly with those young people. That will help them in driving brand impact, social impact, commercial results across the board. That's not the biggest deal to get to that stage. then the individual functions within those departments or within this large corporation are operating in a way that fits into that. So that whether you are running recruitment or whether you are doing new product development for young families, or whether you're thinking more about the global brand approach to this, you're doing it in a far more informed, far more joined up way, and you're thinking about this as more of a community brand approach rather than we're doing the consumer stuff, you do the employee stuff, and we'll go our own way. So I would want that to happen in as many companies as possible. Where it could be in 5 years' time is more young people having, therefore, the access and understanding to how to direct their lives forward. How do I go about getting a job? Who do I go about work for? What are the skills that this company is actually going to teach me in my first few years of working? So what you help do is you help shift the dial for young people themselves. And ultimately, every work that we do has to not only have a benefit for our partners, for our clients, it must have a benefit for young people. Otherwise, there's just no point in us getting up in the morning. So I would want to see in 5 years' time just more organizations, better understanding, matched values, therefore better connections, and you get the win-win out of this. And that's fantastic.
It feels fantastic. I mean, it just feels so the right thing to do. You know, there is nothing else, like you say, because without the support and without the buy-in from this generation, you don't have a business going forward. And, you know, in 5 years' time, you're going to be obsolete. You really are. So it's almost like there is no choice, but it is also at the same breath, it is the right thing to do. So it sounds really exciting, doesn't it?
It is. It is. And we're very lucky. We work with some really exciting clients. We work with people who are pushing us to make a difference for them as a commercial organization and as an organization that exists in its community and wants a positive social impact. And so the more that we can be encouraged by them and encourage them to push both of those levers, the more sustainable it becomes to the organization, the more the positive impact. And the other thing I'm lucky is that the people I work with are just, we have such, people tend to come to us with quite a passion to say, actually, I love the area of work and the skills, but what I love here is the way we're applying those skills. So whether that's consultants, whether that's creatives, whether it's account project people, those who work with data, it's a lot of it is bringing people to say, actually, I want to use my skills to do this rather than to do something that I have been doing up until now. So it's great.
Again, it's the story doing, not the storytelling. I love that. Yes. That was so good. Yeah, it is, you know, and you're clearly living it and breathing it, which is contagious. It really is. And I think for a lot of people listening to this, they'll be thinking, all right, Neil, shut up. Just tell me how I get hold of Mark. How do I contact Mark? Because I need to have a conversation. We've got that same challenge that Mark is describing. Obviously, with the barometer and the network, and there's a whole host of kind of assets and, you know, things that people can get hold of through you. But how best would people contact you?
Oh, well, you know, I'm on email at wearefutures.com, but I'm also on LinkedIn. So anyone can find me through one of those two, of course. I am an occasional Twitter user, but more of a reader than a contributor on that front. We'll just pick up the phone, come and pay a visit.
Great stuff. So we'll put all the links to the various kind of facets and features to get hold of Mark. And
actually, I would also add on that, even if you don't want to reach out to me personally, a lot of what I've provided, the 7 principles social impact barometer, they're all accessible anyway. You can get hold of them for free and you can go and do some of this stuff. So obviously, you know, we're a business, so obviously we would love people to get us in to help them on this, but it's going to be better if everyone does some of this anyway, even if they don't do it with us. And that's why a number of our tools are out there anyway.
Great. All part of building the community of like-minded souls who are going to make this world a better place.
Absolutely.
It's quite simple. Great stuff. This has been a really, really great conversation, Mark. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And I know that people listening will have had huge value. So I just really want to say a big, big thank you for, you know, all the work that you're doing sort of generally, but thank you for your time as well today. It's been really, really good.
Thank you for having me on. It's been fun. I've enjoyed it. Thanks, Neil.